Is it just our echo chamber that there's Bitcoiners seemingly coming to terms with the fact that we have a created earth with a creator that loves us?
The physical world is full of evidence that God exists, that Christ is real, and that angels and demons are real. None of the ways that our universe is currently structured make any sense unless you tie in a creator. There's a coordinated plan of control across the world that's been taking place for years, and it's definitely demonic in origin, I think. The Epstein files are basically proving that this is not a isolated incident. It's a coordinated conspiracy to call demonic power to life.
What would you say drives your passion to understand all this stuff?
I was very rabidly curious about the world. How did Japan play into the carry trade, and how's the carry trade affect Bitcoin and gold and silver? Currently, the majority of the wealth in the world is held by the boomer class, and the boomer class does not understand Bitcoin yet. They understand gold and silver.
Welcome back to the Adam O'Brien Show, where I am on a mission to inspire the next generation. We do that with this show specifically in the relentless pursuit of objective truth through conversation with truth seekers, and specifically lately Bitcoiners. Today, I'm joined by Roberto Rios, previously the Peruvian Bull. And man, this conversation went absolutely, once again, no surprise, in a different direction than I was expecting. I basically have like a little series of notes that I have, and I just can throw those out after the first, after the opening line, because the conversation always takes its own form. Just a quick warning to everyone watching, we dive into some incredibly deep and complex topics, specifically around demons, around the way that the world works with demons in them. We talk a lot about the Epstein files and some sexually explicit content there. And so I really want to make sure that if you're watching this with kids, just please guard them around that. It is very near and dear to my heart that our children remain as innocent as possible for a long time. So please hear that. And if you feel like it's appropriate for them to watch, then that's great. Maybe just skim through the episode first and just see if it's appropriate for you and for your kids to watch. So yeah, you don't want to miss this one. Without further ado, let's jump straight into it with Roberto. We'll dive into you in a minute here, but I'm so deeply interested in, so many Bitcoiners are carnivore, which, you know, is, I think, an interesting Venn diagram overlap. But more importantly, that's an immense amount of discipline to have going on 3 years now, or nearly 3 years. What is it in you that is like driving this carnivore lifestyle?
It's a couple things. I mean, first it's the health benefits, right? Like,
have you noticed some?
Oh, yeah. Oh, easily. Huge.
Like what? Carnivore pill me, Roberto. Come on.
I will carnivore pill you. It's actually, like I said, I thought this was all kind of like ridiculous, but I listened to this podcast called Plant Free MD by Dr. Anthony Chafee. And Chafee actually grew up in Seattle and went to the University of Washington. Very smart guy. And he essentially, through this whole podcast, brings on guests, also does solo episodes where he talks to the science of like why carnivore is good for you and why it's, you know, better than...
What's his name? Plant D?
Plant-based diet, or the plant-free MD.
Oh, plant-free MD. Okay.
Plant-free MD, because he's basically saying like carnivore doctor. And essentially what he says is, which makes a lot of sense, is so for one, like all the vegetables you have are filled with preservatives, right? Insecticides, herbicides, nitrogen, phosphorus, right? All this crap. Second thing is, even if you take away all of that, the vegetables that you see today and the fruits you see today are not the fruits and vegetables from 5,000 years ago.
Dude, they're not made for humans. I saw this thing about a carrot. A carrot used to be like kind of like a form of chemo that they would use in the ancient world because it was so toxic. Like the root was so poisonous, and they just GMO'd the snot out of it to make it the like, and then told us it was good for our eyes to like, you know, get us to eat it. It's absolutely mental.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And even before like outright genetic modification with, you know, reverse transcriptase or CRISPR, which is what they're probably using for, you know, all this GMO products, you could just do this with selective breeding. I mean, I'm sure you remember, you know, Mendel from a biology class, but Mendel was a German scientist, biologist who would crossbreed, you know, different stalks of bean sprouts and see how tall each one would grow, and then see, oh, okay, there's recessive and there's dominant genes, and you could track the alleles via something called Punnett squares. Like, this form of genetic engineering has gone on for literally the last 4,000 or 5,000 years as a part of the industrial and the, more accurately, like agricultural revolution. And so that's meant that the plants and the fruits you see, you know, the vegetables you see today are nothing like what they were 5,000 years ago. If you look up an ancient picture of an apple, it's like this big, it's hard, it has a tiny little like fleshy thing, and there's tons of seeds in the middle. a banana was like tiny, green, hard.
Yeah, the bananas look nasty. And a strawberry too. The old strawberries look so gross.
They're like tiny and they're gross. And now they're big and juicy. And again, it's because they've been genetically engineered for human consumption. So like a modern strawberry has something like 50 times the sugar content of an ancient strawberry, right? And so our ancestors living in, let's say like the northern, northern reaches of the Black Forest in Germany or, you know, in southern Spain or whatever, 10,000 years ago, they weren't able to, you know, find or hunt or eat enough calories from sugar and from fruits and veggies every single day. They would come across it randomly and be able to eat a little bit of it, but it was like literally less than 1% of their calorie intake. It was mostly, you know, meat. So the health benefits were huge. So the first 2 weeks I started noticing my allergies got way better. I have an old shoulder injury.
Are you quite like, you have like the nasal kind of allergies or what kind of allergies do you have?
Yeah. I used to have my allergies are completely gone now. My voice used to sound like this all the time, like 24/7. But now I sound much better, right? My allergies didn't go away completely, but they went away like 30-40% maybe. So like a significant improvement. I had chronic pain in my shoulder from an old skiing injury. The chronic pain went away.
Is that just from joint? Like, because the thesis is that your joints are inflamed from eating a bunch of bad things, or what causes shoulder pain just go away from a diet change?
Because the other thing is that plants, right? Animals have a defense mechanism, right? A cow has a defense mechanism. It lives in a herd and it can run away from you, right? If you're a hunter, you're chasing it. They can all clump together in a herd and run away. Or there's a bull that could charge you, right? Like even herbivorous animals can be aggressive and can actually kill you or hurt you, right? Like elephants or hippopotamus, right? A plant can't move. It can't run away. And so a plant's been created with certain defense mechanisms. And there's many defense mechanisms. The first one is many plants obviously have like thin hairs on them or spikes that can be, deter like consumption or eating. Almost all plants have something called oxalates. Oxalates are tiny. It comes from oxalic acid. And oxalic acid is this compound that's found in the roots and stems of most leafy green vegetables that turns into microscopic crystals once it's metabolized by a mammal. And those crystals get basically embedded in your cell tissues, in your lymphatic system, in your fascia, and cause tiny micro inflammation like constantly in your body. And your body can process oxalates, but it's only can process like 20 milligrams a day. And the average American eats like, 300 milligrams a day of oxalates. So it's something like...
So why is a vegetarian not in just absolute chronic pain? Like how can people go vegan and all of a sudden they just think they're living their... Like I remember Logan Paul in like 2018 before his fight with KSI, he like went vegan and all this stuff. And he was like, I feel amazing. I feel strong. Like, why is that the case?
It's not like if you eat a ton of oxalates, you're going to be in excruciating pain. It's just like a small background.
Okay. Makes it slightly weaker.
Low level pain, right? And the shoulder injury I had wasn't very severe. Like it's not like I had surgery on it or dislocated it. It was like a minor, tear in a muscle or something. But the shoulder pain had been there on like a scale of like maybe 2 out of 10 or 1 out of 10 constantly. And getting rid of the oxalates in my diet just got rid of that low level shoulder pain and some low level back pain that I'd had for a while.
And how long did it take you to clear to your carnivore in, where were you, Colombia?
Colombia, yeah.
With Ben, you're like living I don't know what you're doing there, but I imagine you're just like living it up. You're surfing. When did you write your book?
No, I started my business. That's when I started my business, my Substack. I quit my job in fintech and I started my business I quit my job in August 2023 and I started my business in September.
And when did your book come out?
My book came out January of that year. So January 2023. Yeah.
23. So you were still working your job
I was working my job when I wrote the book. Yeah.
Dude, crazy. Okay. So what do you think it is driving you? You've got this analytical brain, right? You can see it in the way that you're talking about the carnivore diet. You're obviously passionate about that. You see it in your book, obviously, talking about the macroeconomics, talking about, the gold, silver thesis, the Bitcoin thesis, whatever. What else do you apply this analytical side of yourself to?
A lot of things. I mean, I apply it to religion. I apply it to Christianity. I think, and I've said this on Twitter, but I think that the physical world is full of evidence that God exists. And that Christ is real and that, angels and demons are real and that you know, what we understand to be reality is simply just one layer of reality, and that there's a spiritual reality that's probably more important and more consequential than even our physical one, right? Even though our physical one is like the base layer that we understand. And I've come to that conclusion through a lot of different, you know, avenues. My dad is an atmospheric scientist. So he is extremely like well-versed in the scientific method and materialism. And he was initially an atheist, actually, when he was in his early 20s. But he came back to God in his late 20s, partially through meeting my mom, but also partially just because he started realizing that, you know, none of the ways that our universe is currently structured make any sense unless you tie in a creator, right? Some sort of intelligence.
The mental gymnastics that, you know, a materialism kind of worldview has to go through is like, it's a little bit like fiat too, right? Like there's just like, you can string this whole story together, but then at the end of the day, you've got kind of just you got a missing piece, and that's the mental gymnastics that has to occur. So did you grow up in this Christian home then? Your mom and your dad both raising you Christian, or?
Yeah, my mom and dad are both Christian. I went to a Christian high school. I graduated from Gonzaga University, which is Catholic. It's Jesuit. But that wasn't the main reason why, because, you know, I'm like any Bitcoiner. I don't listen to authority, right? I would argue with my teachers famously and tell them that they're wrong to their face. And then that could be, no, about just like, you know, I had one world history teacher, which I don't know why she started talking about science, but she just loved to talk about stuff that she didn't know anything about. And she was telling the class that the seasons change because the earth gets closer and farther from the sun. And this is in 11th grade, right? In this school in Seattle, Washington. And I just told her, no, that's not how the seasons change. The seasons change because the earth is tilted, right? It's like a axial tilt of 13.5 degrees. And that tilt is stable. And as the earth rotates, the angle of the rays that come into the northern hemisphere change, which changes the amount of energy that each hemisphere receives. And this is something I know from my dad, who's an atmospheric physicist and has studied, you know, earth science, geology, astronomy, meteorology. And she told me, no, I'm wrong. And I told her, no, you're wrong. And she said, how do you know what you're talking about? I said, well, my dad's a scientist. He has a PhD. And she said that you're not. And I'm like, you're right, I'm not, but I'm smarter than you. And then that got me, get out of here. What are you saying? I'm going to sit in the office. And I realized that my smart aleck mouth had probably gone a little bit too far. I probably telling the teacher I'm smarter than her.
Nah, man, but that is very Bitcoiner of you. I think that most Bitcoiners can probably, I mean, I have countless stories of this nature, mostly with my parents or like teachers and people of authority that way. Completely. So, okay, walk me through your upbringing then. Like what I want to understand is I'm seeing this rise of spirituality in Bitcoiners. To me, it feels undeniable. And, you know, it could be my echo chamber, but I'm seeing plenty of these Bitcoiners like coming or returning to Jesus, kind of acknowledging his kingdom, acknowledging. Yeah. And so what do you think is happening in Bitcoiners? Is it just like the Myers-Briggs? Julian always talks about this, the like ENTJ and the INTP and all this stuff and how there's a big overlap there. What is happening? Or is it just our echo chamber that there's Bitcoiners seemingly like coming to terms with the fact that we have a created earth with a creator that loves us, came down to earth, died, rose again, and is coming back soon?
Yeah, I think what is the common factor is, and again, this is the irony, is that a lot of people will, especially the atheists, right? I call them the armchair, the Reddit atheists, will decry Christianity as illogical, right? As nonsensical, as mystical. Oh, you just believe in something you can't see. You have all these theories about,
right? It's the Greek gods.
Yeah, it's just like, exactly. It's just like pantheism. It's just like all these other things. But my belief is that Christianity is actually a fundamental revelation of like the actual nature of reality, right? And again, we can go back to Christian apologetics. We can go back to, you know, biology, the gravitational constant, for example, in the universe is so precise. If you change it by 1/100 of 1%, everything would fly apart. And if you change it the other way, everything would be crushed together. Same with the strong nuclear force. Same with the weak nuclear force. Same with the ratio between the strong and the weak nuclear force. And so when you think about the universe on that scale, it's like, if you switch any of these variables, nothing would exist. And then their retort is, well, there are multiple universes. There's infinite universes. There's a multiverse. And then I ask them, well, okay, well, let's turn the question on you then. Where's the proof of that? You say that I believe in a God that has no proof. And now you're claiming there's a trillion universes out there and you have no proof of them. So you're making leaps of faith in your own model to describe our reality. How is what I'm doing any different? And actually mine, I would argue, is much more logical than yours.
At least there's some historical documents that, show some level of evidence towards it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I think, again, I think religion, especially obviously, Christianity, monotheism, that is a fundamental description of how our reality works, how it came to be, and why it's functioning the way it is. And it's hidden. Yes, you have to look for it. Yes, you have to meditate. You have to pray. You'll see little signs in your life. But it's just like the Matrix, like these little hints that are being dropped. And the people that are paying attention, which are, many Bitcoiners are very clued into this stuff, are picking that up. And so I don't think it's a commonality in all Bitcoiners are religious or they're already that religious. I think that they're people that are seeing through the Matrix and understanding the truth of our world. And just like they understood the truth about Bitcoin, they saw all these little seeds of, oh, wow, no one got arrested in 2008. And, nobody really went to jail for what happened. And the central bank has continued to print money and that they're using, new forms of quantitative easing to create credit and to push it out into the economy and fund endless wars. Wow, there's like this system of power and control. They can also relate that to the spiritual side and see, oh, wow, like there's actual intelligent designer behind all this.
Yeah, you said something in there. You said the Matrix is like covering it, or the Matrix is hiding, or seeing through the Matrix. Is this, because I would agree, the fact that no one goes to jail in 2008, the fact that you have to see through a Matrix to find reality is mind blowing. Do you think that's intentional, or is this just a, unfortunate consequence of man?
I think it's intentional. And I mean, the Epstein files just came out this week, right? And that, you look at, I'm sure you've seen there's hundreds of examples of this, but here's one. In 2014, Jeffrey Epstein was emailing somebody whose name was redacted, and he was asking for a $14,000 payment to a bank account at Wachovia Bank, which was named Baal. And Baal, B-A-A-L, is an ancient Canaanite deity that people would sacrifice children to, right? So demonic, right? That's clearly, he was stereotypically photographed or pictured as this, obviously not photographed, but, pictured, imaged as this goat with three heads holding a child and asking for, the child's life or asking for blood sacrifice or some sort of
But this is Epstein, the bank.
Epstein named himself, no, he named his bank account Baal, B-A-A-L in the files. They also, obviously there's tons of, Kabbalistic and demonic references in the files where they would, draw pentagrams in the blood of children. There was obviously revelation that George Bush Sr. was eating, the entrails of children. Like, these things are things that you hear about from the, medieval times of satanic occult practices. And they're being brought to light by at the highest power, highest levels of government, of politics, of finance, of media, of culture, almost everyone universally. Like, the Epstein files are basically proving that this is not a isolated incident of just a few people being crazy and evil. It's a coordinated conspiracy to, I think, call demonic power to life and to use that power to control and manipulate and, deceive people, which is really, really dark. Right. Because why would they do this? Right. I got into this argument with a guy in Nasser. He said, oh, they're just, I can't believe you believe all this. I'm like, you don't believe in demons? You don't believe that? So there's these little girls saying that they saw these things, and there's people, their personal accounts so horrific. And you think all these elites are taking all this risk to do all these things, to horrific things to people just for the hell of it, just for shits and giggles? Like, no, they're doing something real with it. And what the real thing behind it is the demonic influence and the demonic power that they're trying to gain from. They're trying to gain some sort of spiritual power, whether that's remote viewing, whether that's clairvoyance, whether that's learning information about the future, right? Because demons and angels and all these things exist semi outside of space time. And so they have access to information that we don't have access to. So it's really evil, I believe. And I believe that it's a spiritual war that we're fighting, and it exists on obviously more than just one plane.
Yeah, man, it is a spiritual war. I would agree with that. Walk me through walk me through that process of what are they trying? So first of all, you think that these people, you think that they could be demons in and of themselves, or are they just men who are trying to sold your soul to the devil kind of idea? And then is it strictly after power and fame? How short-sighted can you be to think that selling your soul to the devil or equivalent is a reasonable way to gain like earthly treasure? Like what's your take on the reasons why?
Yeah. So I think first of all, I think they're human. You know, obviously there's
being like the Epsteins,
the Maxwells, right? The George Bush Senior allegedly on a boat, like eating children, like these things. I think that they're human people who are so fallen and so broken that they believe that they can gain spiritual power, shortcut to spiritual power, to true spiritual power.
Spiritual power, okay.
To demons, yeah.
So you think they've been deceived? Like, because obviously, I think the Bible's pretty clear that man cannot achieve spiritual power. Like, I mean, I think there's spiritual forces that can corrupt man, but I'm not sure that we can achieve spiritual power. But you would be thinking that the devil or whomever, the demons have been telling them, yo, you can achieve greatness in the spiritual realm if you follow me. Is that kind of the thought process?
Yeah, essentially. You know, demons are like, I've been a little curious to dig into this rabbit hole. I don't want to go too deep into it because, you know, it's really, really dark. But I believe, you know, demons are essentially like disembodied spirits that are stuck in, you know, another plane of existence. And they're almost like a concentrated version of like the worst human emotions, right? Fear, anger, hate, you know, lust. And so they feed off of human emotions and they want to see you doing these evil things. It actually creates energy for them on another dimension that they can, you know, feed off of like as an energy source. And so the reason why they're trying to get people to do things is because they themselves have very limited effect on the physical plane. They can't really do things. And so what they want is they want to perpetrate their evil deeds, but they can't do it. You know, they can't like incarnate next to you and like have three horns and a pitchfork and stab you. So what they're going to do is they're going to try to convince somebody, hey, if you do what I want, I'm going to give you some information. I'm going to give you some power. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen with the stock market next year. I'm going to tell you what your competitor is going to do. I'll kill your competitor for you. Right. And so they'll do those kinds of, you know, strategic temptation, carrot dangling tricks in order to get people to do what they want. But what they don't understand is, at least from what I've read, especially like even in the mystic traditions where people have stupidly followed down this path, you never make a deal with a demon that ends well. Because what the demon wants is something far more important than even the evil act. The demon wants a part of you. And so ultimately, when you do these things, it almost always backfires in a very negative way, right? And you know, like I've heard tons of stories. I heard one story of a guy, and again, this is an account from another person I know, so I'm not going to reveal names or anything, but I heard one story of a guy who knew a friend who was trying to gain spiritual powers, and this friend wanted to meet this author really badly. And so he was researching how to meet him, and this is like the late 90s, so they're, you know, internet wasn't still very big, so it was hard to
meet. Twitter DMs to jump into.
No Twitter DMs to jump into. So he's like, I want to meet the author, and I'm going to try like doing essentially a pentagram and, you know, killing a goat and calling forth an entity, and I want the entity to find me the author and have me meet him. And the guy did the ceremony. He said that the lights started flickering. You know, you couldn't see anything, but he felt terrified, and he kind of sensed that there was an entity inside the circle. He asked it to do these certain things. And a week later, he had asked to meet this author. A week later, he's walking next to a library, just had gotten out of, you know, out of a study session, and a truck pulls up, and the guy opens the back of the truck, and all the author's books fall out onto the pavement. And he goes back to his apartment, and the pentagram he had drawn was all like, you know, steaming, and like he essentially heard a voice while he neared it that said, I completed your task. That's it. And he was terrified because he'd asked to meet the actual author, but he hadn't specified, I want to meet the person. And then the demon had just given him the books of the author, right? And it's like, that you said meet him, here's the meeting. And then he realized, he said, if that's true, if the demon could have just gotten the books for me, then the demon could have also coordinated the author to be driving his car and get in a car accident, his body fly out and hit the pavement next to me. And that would be meeting him. And so the point of the story is to show, like, when the demon, if you make those kinds of deals with a demonic entity, he does not have to follow your rules, right? It, he can do what he wants and interpret how you want. And then when he comes back, he'll usually request a piece of your soul or, you know, something of value to you, your firstborn child, your, you know, your grandma, your mother. Like it is not something anyone has any business doing unless they want to be, you know, damning their soul for an eternity, right? For a tiny gain in this physical plane.
Dude, this is making my, obviously we've discussed a little bit in like our church or community group or whatever, you know, talk a little bit about spiritual warfare, but I think this is such an important conversation. I think Jesus is so clear about the spiritual warfare that exists. Like, I'm sure there's hundreds of stories like this. I had some friends that grew up, I went to a Christian school for 11 and 12. Some of my friends went to Africa for a mission trip when they were out there, and they saw a bunch of like witch doctors and all kinds of, you know, insane spiritual warcraft going on. It's there and it exists and it's real. What on earth are we doing? Like, why isn't it talked about more? Do you think it's actively being suppressed? Do you think it's just too like scary and uncomfortable to talk about? Is that the demons are just, you know, suppressing it? I guess it's just a general trend towards secularism. If you don't believe that there's a God, then of course you don't believe that there's demons. And I think that's probably the devil's greatest trick, now that I think about it. Like, his greatest trick is convincing people he doesn't exist so that he gets to, you know, play around and corrupt people's souls. But why don't we talk about this more as a human species?
I think for a couple of reasons. Obviously, I do think that there's a coordinated push at the highest levels to deny that the spiritual realm is real.
Who's the highest levels? Like at the God, or sorry, at the like...
At no, the, at the governmental, at the central bank, at the, you know, academia, at the financial institutions, right? Highest levels.
Yeah, so then is that because there are demons running or influencing the people at the heads of that? Like, I'm kind of at the point now where I don't believe you can be... We just did a bunch of interview questions today, and I think I said this, like, I don't believe you can be the head of a massive institution without being captured in some way. Or is it the other way? Is it that once you get there, you become like, do you only get there by being captured? Or once you get there, do you become captured?
I actually think it's both, but it's probably more the former, right? More like you are already compromised or captured, and then you get into the power. And then the off chance that you get there without it, then they do something to capture you, right? They, you know, Epstein was a perfect example, right? It was a mutual blackmail ring. They entice you to have sex with underage girls, and they film you doing it. And they say, if you ever mess with us, we're going to release this. We're going to destroy your reputation. We're going to destroy everything you've ever thought, you know, loved, and everyone you've ever cared about. And so I think that that's real. And the people who don't obey, like a JFK, are killed. And so when you see like death and destruction or personality or reputation, you know, annihilation, and then the other side promises you riches and women and parties and fun and status and fame and all the promises of this world, it's very easy for most people to take that route, right? You can see how enticing that is.
Totally. Yeah, it's the high time preference of the fiat world. So then where's Trump in that? Is that earshot? Is that real, or is that just playing it up?
I mean, I think Trump is compromised at this point, right? He was opposed to getting the Epstein files released. He was even quoted as saying that the Epstein files were meaningless and that, you know, no one really paid attention to them or they didn't have any impact. And obviously he's been named in them multiple times, flying to both Epstein's island, from what I hear, and also Epstein's apartment in New York, having sex with prostitutes. You know, Bill Gates was also obviously famously all over the Epstein files. And so again, I think it's a method of control and of manipulation and of deception that is able to permeate these power structures and make sure that they remain in place, right? Because that's kind of their ultimate goal, right? They want to continue, like, have a continuation of power for as long as they can. Right. And they'll leave you clues. You know, they, like, for example, when CERN opened, which is the particle accelerator in I think it's Switzerland, they built a giant statue of the goddess Shiva, which is the goddess of destruction in Indian mythology, next to the next to the facility. And they unveiled it. And if you go back and watch the 2017, or I think it's like 2017, 2016 opening of CERN, it's full of demonic imagery, right? And so why would they do this if none of this was real, right? Why would they just make it all up and do it for fun, for kicks and giggles, and hide it there and spend millions of dollars on a ceremony and building a statue just for fun? It's like, no, they're actively paying homage to entities, right, that they are potentially even consulting with. And it's terrifying, but it also kind of rationalizes why we have the world we do have today, right? You look at the modern globe, right, the nation states. I think it's something like, you know, there's what, 120 countries or something, maybe 150 countries, something like 90% of them have central banks, right? The only 12, like I remember people have famously posted this on Twitter, like there's 12 countries in 2000 that didn't have central banks. Libya, Syria, North Korea, right? Or Rothschild controlled central banks. Libya, Syria, North Korea, Iran, Venezuela. And they're like, who are we demonizing the most in the media? It's like, those are the countries. Those are the countries that get overthrown. Those are the countries that see their leaders toppled. And not to say that their leaders are necessarily like good or moral people, but I definitely believe that there's a coordinated plan of control across the world that's been taking place for years. And it's definitely demonic in origin, I think.
Do you think years or centuries?
Centuries.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I've kind of come to this too, which leads me to this interesting place of I heard a church sermon this week about, it was kind of like a Calvinist church sermon. It was kind of like this, you know, are you familiar with Calvinism and Arminianism? Yeah. So like this kind of concept of like predestination, this kind of concept of like, you know, God's plan is already played out and we are just kind of going through the motions towards having it right now. And I just can't, and it really messed up my like time perception of like, what is reality? And you know, it kind of led me to the same spot that I'm feeling now, which is like apathy. It's kind of just like, why bother? The world, you know, we're talking about all these like children eating demons that really are in charge of the world. What's our response? And I want you to answer that in three parts. So what's your response at the highest level as just a human? Then what's your response as a Bitcoiner? But then I think lastly, and most importantly, what's your response as a Christian?
Sure. Those are some good questions. The first one, I'd say, you know, everyone on the Epstein list has to be arrested yesterday. And the nice thing to do...
Who arrests them? Like, this is kind of where I get to, is like, the government is the one that is captured. And so it's like, they're writing their own rules as they break them.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's part of the reason why we need Bitcoin. Maybe we need a revolution and we need a new government, you know? I'm not going to make any calls. I'm not going to say that that's what needs to happen. But if you wanted to arrest them and didn't want, you know, government forces who are captured getting in the way, you'd have to dissolve the government and reform it, right, in some way. And so I would say fundamentally arresting them and throwing them in jail and throwing away the key in a hole is the nice thing to do.
Do you think it matters, though? Like if they're truly in tune with demonic powers, like if a demon can steal a truck full of books and coordinate this, like, you know, I think the Bible is also clear. I mean, this is obvious. This is a spiritual conversation now, right? This is we're talking spiritual realm here. Like, I just don't know how we've got the people on the Epstein list. They're in jail, off they go. But like, could they, like, how far does this corruption go? Are the guards not there? Are the demons not already in the jail waiting to release them? Like, does that even matter? Is there, and maybe this is where we get into like more the Christian side, but you know, does applying earthly force to a demonic force really, is it meaningful in preventing it?
It works somewhat, and I'll tell you why. In the spiritual plane, all human beings and all conscious entities have free will, right? God has ordained everything with free will. Which means that, like, for a demon to hurt you, if you are not freely giving it that power, it's harder for the demon to do it. Now, there are cases of it happening, obviously, but it seems that there's this, like, you know, I guess you call like astral or spiritual law of non-violation of personal agency that has to be followed. And so the reason why the demons have power is because not because they force themselves in, but it's because they were invited in. So the people who are getting these demonic influences, they're not like, there's not a demon that shows up in their, you know, in their room in the middle of the night and forces themselves. And now they're evil. They are seeking power. And the way that they're seeking power is by calling demonic influences into their life. You know, Lex Wexner, for example, the guy who ran, he ran, I think, Victoria's Secret and Gentleman's Quarterly, the magazines. And he was running a similar Epstein-style scheme for decades on young men because he was a gay pedophile who was, you know, violating young men who were young models in the fashion industry and covering all of it up, right? On these islands, on these, in these apartments, in these yachts. And he said in a 1989 interview with Life magazine that he had a demon in his head. And the demon he'd asked to come in when he was a little boy. And the demon would whisper things to him and tell him what to do. Tell him what to do with business. Tell him, oh, don't take advantage of this person. They have a strong family. Like they'll know. Take advantage of that boy. He's an orphan. Right. And so it would feed him information. So that doesn't necessarily imply like complete demonic control, like an exorcism would, but it's a level of influence. Right. And he wanted it. He was claiming in this interview that he wanted the business prowess. He wanted the financial power. He wanted the influence. He wanted the fame. And he wanted to do these things to other people to violate them, right, sexually. And so he was enabled by the demon to do that. And so that's the same way I see it. It's like if you put a, you know, because if that's the logic, then on this plane, we have no way of fighting back, right? So,
well, I mean, that's kind of where I, go ahead.
I was going to say, obviously we can call to Christ, we can cry out to angels, right? But that idea that like, oh, you know, someone's in prison, they're praying for a demon to get them out and the demon will mind control the guard and the guard will mindlessly go and do that. That generally is, yeah, I don't believe that really can happen.
No, but yeah, I don't think I was thinking like zombie attack, but I was thinking more like, you know, like we read in the Bible, God like sending an earthquake to break Paul out of jail, Paul and John, you know, if in my mind, it's like, if the demon can steal the truck full of books or, you know, whatever, however that happened.
It didn't steal it. It was coordinating that it arrived at a certain time. Yeah. But yeah, I see.
Coordinated arrived at a certain time. Yeah. Then like certainly he could coordinate, at least help a prison escape, you know, Shawshank Redemption style or not. But yeah, it kind of, you know, so then I go through this period of like apathy and then I'm leaning now into like, because we are also taught in scripture that the power of prayer and like praying Jesus into these demonic forces is kind of the cure. We were talking actually just last night with some friends, went to their house for dinner and she was telling me that, dude, it's actually very similar to what you're talking about. She just had a kid and she was terminally ill. Not my friend, but this is a friend of a friend. So I don't know this firsthand, but I've heard this is secondhand. And she's terminally ill. She just gets super sick and the doctors are just like, you're cooked. Like you're out of here. 1 to 2 years and you're over. And her brother or her brother-in-law or something starts reading about spirituality, spiritual influence. They were Christians. She was like, allegedly the perfect Christian, saved herself from marriage, didn't party, you know, went to church, baptized, like all this stuff. And her brother, who's also a Bible believing Christian, starts reading the Bible, praying, and he feels like, hey, there's something demonic, something, some kind of demon is, you know, I don't remember if it was a sister or sister-in-law. Anyways, so they go to talk to this pastor in Toronto, who is apparently like, you know, one of the more knowledgeable pastors on this, and they have a series of deliverance. Basically, like, and I don't know how the whole story went, but like the pastor delivers this lady from the demon. She's like healthy, all symptoms, all problems, completely gone. And later it came to that her like great great grandmother or something was like was playing around, messing around with like witchcraft, sorcery, like all kinds of nonsense. And it just goes to show how, you know, you said it earlier today, like they're going to ask for your firstborn. Oh, I remember now. The curse was that all firstborn women in the family would die. This was the generational curse that was put onto, and like she was the firstborn woman. And you could see through the family tree, this continuing to happen. Just blows my mind. So it to me, it puts an immense amount of urgency behind, like, we got to get Jesus back. Like, we got to get Jesus top of mind here. We got to kind of like bring him into the conversation.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, I think that, again, this spiritual warfare stuff is so real that if you look far enough, you look hard enough, you will find examples of it everywhere, right? Like there's, I mean, I have personal stories. My brother, you know, had a, he's a property manager and he's had a haunted house in the Seattle area that he's had to deal with and had demonic influences there. And then whenever he visited, he'd come home and have demonic dreams for multiple nights in a row and the water would stop. He was not really a Christian, but you know what? After he went through all that, like this was like March 2024, you better believe he started praying.
Wow, dude, isn't that interesting? That
he asked for a Bible. Yeah, he was an
atheist. You know, everyone, I'm an atheist. I'm this, I'm that. And then you get into trouble and it's like, yo, Jesus, where are you at?
Exactly. And so he had all of us, we bought crucifixes for everyone, all of the brothers in the family. And he started praying, he bought a Bible and he started turning to God.
So he brought you in. He was like, Roberto, I got problems.
I was already on to this, but this started to get him in, finally clued in. And it also just confirmed what I already knew, right? To see someone I know and care about going through this and starting to see spiritual warfare, right? Like the water would stop working randomly in his house. He lost his electricity twice because a squirrel ran into a transformer, but it's the transformer that only goes to his apartment unit. And this happened like two times in the space of like 4 days. And the power company said, we've never seen like this transformer is designed to keep animals out. And somehow two times a squirrel got in, touched the exact two wires it needed to touch to fry the whole thing and to cut your power. So like, again, anecdotal, sure. That happened a week after he went to this house and had been there and had started to have demonic dreams and like terrifying dreams of people, things chasing him in the woods or things trying to get into his house and trying to hurt him, right? That he never had before, right? So it's definitely real. It's definitely real. But earlier you asked me those three questions, right? Like, what do you do as a person, as a Bitcoiner, and as a Christian? As a person, again, throwing them away in bridge jail is the nice option. The not so nice option is obviously like public hanging and execution, capital punishment. And maybe that's the better option, right?
What's your, just hang on, before you go, keep going. I don't remember what the take was, but is capital punishment biblical, do you think?
I think that that's an interesting debate. I think there's an argument to be made on both sides. I think you could say that someone should be living until the very last moment so they have maximum chances to repent, right? And to believe. But if you're more Calvinist / like, you know, what's the word? Like, you believe, you know, predetermination, you believe that everyone who's been saved is already like destined to be saved and there's nothing you can really do, then capital punishment makes all the sense in the world because this person is not saved. They don't want to be saved and they're too far gone and, you know, leaking them alive.
Right. It's not that they wouldn't want to be saved. It's that God didn't destine them to be saved, which is kind of a crazy, that's where I get out of line on this Calvinist. I just can't quite get there. I think the Bible is so clear that Jesus died for everyone. You know, God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Go and make disciples of all nations. Like, I think that we're just called time and time again to share the gospel. It's like, what's the point of sharing the gospel if everyone's already predetermined to be, you know, with God at the end?
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's what I've asked Calvinists too, and they don't really have a good answer. So
mental gymnastics.
I don't love the predestination theology, but I've thought like, man, my theory is the best way to deal with all this stuff is you take all the pedophiles and the mass murderers and the serial killers, and you go out and you find an island in the middle of the Pacific, right? And you airdrop some tents and some bows and arrows and some pigs on the island and some fishing rods. And you just drop them there and say, good luck, you know?
Like Alcatraz.
Yeah, like Alcatraz. We're not going to necessarily like execute you, capital punishment, but this is your island. You're living as if it's 400 BC right now. You have no technology. You have no way of contacting anybody. We'll put a perimeter of drones around, you know, 30 miles out from the island. No one's going to get in and you're not building a raft to get out. And this is where you'll live for the rest of your life and you'll die here of old age, right? Or you'll kill each other, but that's your own free will, right? That's your own.
Yeah. Have at her. What do you think would, let's game theory this out. So I think inevitably they reproduce. There's enough of them that they would need a very
big... You could castrate. I mean, I think biblically you could castrate them before they go.
Oh, okay.
Would that be the most wrong thing? And also you have one island for males and one island for females. Why would you put both on one island? If there's serial rapists, why would you put a woman there? You know?
Dude, I've never considered this. I guess it probably, to your point, would be mostly men.
It would be mostly men. And some people call it barbaric. I'd say what they do is barbaric. and, you know, executing them, I understand, like, it's, there's some moral considerations. You drop them on an island. You give them the, you don't give them the food every day. You give them the supplies that they can get their own food, and it's up to them.
Yeah, yeah. Like you said, some pigs, here's some chickens. Like,
yes, here's some pigs, some chickens. What, we'll airdrop the, you know, here's a way to boil water from, you know, you can, you'll have to build a fire, but here's a way to boil seawater and turn it into drinkable water. We'll drop you the canteens and like the process you need to make it and the instructions.
Oh, you think, see, I think in this, you'd have to be a one-time drop.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. It's a, you know, you don't come back. You one time drop on the island and then you drop the 500 guys there and just say, good luck, figure it out. If you lose things, your problem. Make up, make your own knife, make your own fishing rod.
Dang, dude. I've never considered that. I think that would be, more efficient than jail.
And then you don't pay any, dude, you basically don't pay any money, right? To upkeep it. All you need is like a couple drones or even a satellite, probably like a live action satellite that just, a couple of them that just watch the water and make sure nobody tries to swim away or build a raft. And you have it far enough.
Well, how they couldn't swim away, I don't think. I think you'd be mostly just concerned about like a rescue mission, hey?
Yeah, yeah. Concerned about someone trying to drive a boat in. And then you just tell them like, hey, if you try to drive a boat to this island, we'll, you know, we have drones that will airstrike you. So don't do that, please. Right? Or we'll have the Coast Guard drive up to your boat and arrest you if you do that.
You'd think we could get the equivalent of the Antarctica Treaty to like go ahead on this island too and just keep it under wraps, under lock.
I think so. Think about how many nations would love to just get rid of their most violent serial killers and not have to pay to like give them food and housing and watch over them 24/7.
Yeah, man.
Just build a bunch of island chains in the middle. You could even build them artificially, like China's been doing in the South China Sea since 2014. You just build them in the middle of nowhere. Right? You find a coral reef, or maybe not coral reef, you don't want to build on that, but like find a sandbar, you dump a bunch of sand, a bunch of rocks, build an artificial island, you know, drop a bunch of hatchets, a bunch of fishing rods, a bunch of fire starter, you know, give them the tools that they would need to survive on this like 10 mile by 15 mile island. Good luck. Bye-bye.
And so what do you think, like, is this just too much of a distant dream? It's like, this is fine in theory, but it's like, difficult practically to introduce. Like this legitimately sounds, you know, fine. Better than capital punishment, I would say. Better than like putting them behind bars and
better than eternal jail and you and I paying forever for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or just printing the money to make it happen. Yeah. So why not? Like what's the, you know, is it because the government doesn't want to go to their island later, or what's the deal?
I think, well, first off, the government has a lack of imagination, right? Government bureaucrats are not. I came up with this idea just thinking about it like, you know, a couple months ago, but they just have a lack of imagination. There's a lack of willpower to do anything about this because
what are you thinking about normally that you're just thinking about capital punishment in this way? Like, what are you just lying in bed considering ways to like, you know, keep the torturers out of the streets or what?
Hey man, I believe that you need to hate evil and love good. Right. And it's a dichotomy where a lot of Christians don't want to admit the other side of that. They won't say, oh, I don't hate evil. I don't hate anybody. I wouldn't hate anything. And it's like, no, you don't understand that opposing evil is actually a moral good. It is a necessity, right? It's not just enough to be, you know, a kumbaya, dance around the fire. We all love each other. It's so good. Because then what do you do in the face of ultimate evil? What do you do in the face of a demon? What do you do in the face of Satan himself? You know, do you oppose him or do you just stand there and say, I'm just love, I'm passive, I'm going to stand here and not do anything while you kill and rape and murder people? No, you have to stop him. You have to do something about it. And yeah, I've been thinking about this, you know, for a while. Like, what do you do about these people that are fundamentally broken? Maybe they're, you know, maybe they went through horrific things in their childhood and that's why they're the way they are. Maybe they're just psychopaths, right? Because there's a certain percentage of the population that is just born psychopathic, right? They have no human emotions. They don't mind tricking people, conning people, hurting people, even killing people, right? Elizabeth Theranos is an example of like a lower level psychopath, right? She conned investors out of billions of dollars for, or Elizabeth Holmes from the company Theranos for her blood company, right? And she has no remorse over it. So they asked her, do you feel bad about? Nope, don't care. And so people like that, I think they don't have no place in society. But the question is, again, how do you get rid of them without like being cruel yourself? And I think the best way is that separation.
Talk about what you just said, no place in society. Doesn't that kind of contradict this like made in the image of God kind of biblical truth?
I don't think so, because I think I would say, what do you say to all their victims? And what do you say to the continual victims that they're going to create as they continue?
Well, what do you, yeah, totally, man. I mean, what do you say to Abel, who got slashed by Cain? Like, what do you say to Jesus, who got killed by the Jews? Like, I think that we know the world is evil, but I don't know that I would say you have no place in society. Like, I mean, could that even be a generational curse? Could that be a demon manifesting itself into psychopathic behavior? Like, I think there's, and so I guess the question becomes, and maybe let's like, then it's like the second question or third question, I guess, but as a Christian, like, where do you leave room for Jesus to drive, I guess?
I think Jesus is driving in their everyday life. I think he's a parent, right? In their everyday life, in their everyday way, in every waking moment, there's little hints that he's there. But the problem is most people aren't listening. They aren't paying attention. And if you put them on an island, you know, you could also include Bibles on the island, and they can find Jesus. They can find Jesus in an island in the Pacific, drinking out of their coconut and staring at the water, which they'll never cross. That's where they can find Jesus, right? I think fundamentally, I understand where you're coming from. Like, oh, we need to have this grace for them. And I agree. We need to have grace. We need to have forgiveness. And the grace and forgiveness ultimately on the human realm is not enough to cover the sins that they've done, right? When you forgive somebody on the human plane, it's for you, really, right? It's not even for the other person. It's for you to get rid of that anger, that hate, that regret, whatever it is, so that you can absolve yourself of that sin and move forward positively. So I think that, you know, putting him on the island is the ultimate moral thing to do, in the sense that you're not only solving, like, you know, solving them, not victimizing any other more people, but also solving the problem of you're not damning them to death. You're not killing them. You're not taking any, actually, you're really not taking much agency out of their hands other than their agency to hurt other people. You're putting them on a place where they have no technology. They have no access to firearms. They have no access to drugs. They have no access to anything else that could harm other people. And there's no innocent people there. Everyone else who's there is also just like them. And now they have to come face to face with their own actions. And they have the rest of their life, literally, to figure it out. And I hope they do. And we can airdrop, we can use a drone to airdrop Bibles, you know, once a year on there. There you go. And hope that they find the truth.
Yeah, I like this thought experiment. I've not spent enough time, I don't think. I mean, clearly, not as much as you, thinking about ways to fix society in this way. But I'm always I'm always torn between my logic center, which, like, this sounds very logical, against the, you know, the like biblical teachings, the way that we are called to live based on the teachings of the Bible, which I think, frankly, you know, I'm not sure anyone on earth has the ability to kind of like summarize or understand the entire thing. When you really dive into it, like, there's some insane stuff going on in the Bible. And I don't know that we do a good job in church as Christians really understanding like what the Bible says and the crazy part about me is, like, you know, back to the Calvinism thing, like, that exists. There's biblical passage to justify that. And then there's biblical passage to like counteract it. And it's a mind bender, man. I don't understand. It's like obviously bigger than me, but it blows my mind that we don't just spend all of our time investigating this. Like, it's so deeply fascinating and interesting.
Let me ask you this. If somebody, let's say there's a guy in the street who's drunk, who's randomly assaulting people, is it moral to stop him? Is it moral to call the police and the police physically restrain him and remove him from the situation?
100%. Absolutely.
How is this any different? How is it any different than a drunk man who is not in control of himself, hurting people? How is that not any different from a psychopath or a serial killer or a serial rapist or a serial pedophile taking them and saying, you, anytime you're in society, you keep doing these things? And again, I'm not saying do this with the shoplifter. I'm not saying doing this with the dude caught smoking weed on a Thursday night in the park. Okay. Those people can go to a normal jail and be rehabilitated. But what a lot of things, you know, like El Salvador has proven is that the crime statistics are a Pareto distribution. 90% of the crime is being caused by 1% of the population. And these, again, these are people who are dysfunctional. They're people who are drug addicted. They're psychopathic. They're sociopathic. You know, they might just be fundamentally choosing to be evil, right? And as Christians, we struggle with that. We struggle with, oh, all these people are I chose to be good. And so therefore other people should choose to be good. But if there exists good, then there also exists evil. There's a binary that exists in morality. And so that means, and because of free choice that God has granted us, that means people can choose evil. Even if they're not a psychopath, even if they're not a sociopath, even if nothing bad happened to them personally, they can choose to do evil just because they want to. That's a free choice that they have.
Well, I think that's the scary part. And that's probably why I would like, why I kind of like this theory. But I think where I would come back to is just the promise of grace that Jesus has. And to your point, maybe you chuck a Bible down there and you know, pray for them and off they go. But I don't know that this level of like the drunk man sobers up and the drunk man maybe feels remorse. And so the line, I mean, it's a hypothetical. So, we're probably going to be able to semantic this to death, but yeah, it's a cool thought experiment to kind of consider like how it works.
My question is, yes, the drunk man sobers up and yes, he, you know, will stop doing it temporarily. What if he keeps doing it? What if he keeps beating his wife? What if he keeps beating his kids? What if they stop him 20 times and he does it 21 times?
Totally, man. No, listen, I think it's absolutely heinous.
How much grace can you give them if they keep doing this?
No, well, at that point, it's not grace, right? At that point, you're actively harming, you're putting people at risk. And I think it's atrocious when you see, yeah, the level of disgust and problems going on. And it's like, oh, they had a history. Oh, they were just released from jail. They were out of jail for 3 months. It's like, it's gross. And, yeah. And so like, I'm like, yeah, like I said, like, I'm not like, opposed or wrestling. I'm trying to understand as there's like, that's where the logic center fits in pretty nice. Where does the spiritual side fit in is kind of my, like, that's always my wrestle back and forth. Which is fun.
And I think, and I'll say this, I know you probably want to move on from this, but I think this is the last point I'll make. I actually think, again, I think the spiritual side would be in alignment with this, with the idea. And the reason why Adam Smith has a really good quote, he said, mercy to the guilty is cruelty to the innocent, right? If someone is psychopathically committed to causing harm, letting them continue is a moral sin. If you see a man pushing children into a frozen lake and he keeps 1, 2, 3, 4, and you say, well, we need to give him grace. We need to give him mercy. Yes, we do. And he can have that mercy and grace in a jail cell while he's not doing those harmful things to people. And, you know, how weak is your faith that you believe that if you put someone on an island and isolate them, you know, and just give them a Bible, that there's no way that they could ever come to Christ unless they were in society with all of us and had access to a firearm and has access to drugs and alcohol, and people, random people walking on the street don't know that this is a serial killer or a serial rapist, right? I'm not saying that's your position. I'm not saying, but I'm saying as a hypothetical, like, again, you're actively, I would say there's no functional difference between putting them in jail for the rest of their life and putting them on an island for the rest of their life. There's not really any functional difference. The difference is we're spending way more money watching them. We have an infrastructure. There's even a private prison system that profits off of this. Right? They have opportunity to actually, because there's obviously jail fights, there's drugs that are smuggled in, there's weapons. They have opportunities to hurt other people that are, not as evil as they have been. I think leaving them on an island, airdropping them, you know, some Bibles and praying for them is the best thing you can do. And if they're going to have an encounter with Christ and turn their life around, they can do that there. Right. And they can repent and they will be saved. Right. Because as we know from the thief on the cross, you know, he committed his life to Christ at the very end. And Christ said, you know, verily, verily, I say to you, you'll be with me in heaven today. And so we know that you can be saved at the end. And I don't think it's ungraceful to just separate them and let them live their life, you know, away from society. It's what El Salvador is doing. It's been working amazing wonders for their crime rate.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing you said there, I can dispute. I like where your head's at. And to your point, it's not too much different from that. Moving through kind of this, you've kind of been like you're quite knowledgeable. You know, we've chatted a handful of times, we got to hang out, but you know, you're quite knowledgeable in this like theology. You've obviously quite successful on the like macroeconomics. You know, you got your dad's a space wizard, or
atmospheric scientist.
I think space wizard is probably better.
He's a cloud wizard.
Okay. Your dad's a cloud wizard. What would you say drives your passion to understand all this stuff? You know, bring up historical examples, have the theology, have the passion to not just, you know, rot on a couch and watch TikTok. Like what's your driving force here?
I think ever since I was a young boy, I was very like curious, you know, I was very rabidly curious about the world. I wanted to know why everything worked. I wanted to know how it worked. I wanted to know the functioning of exactly, you know, how you get from A to B to C with a certain process, right? Whether it's cell division and like, you know, creation of life, or if it's something more, you know, physical, like, you know, financial transactions, or, you know, like how economies function, right? And so I've just been taking myself on this quest of learning how the world works, learning how everything fits in together, learning how does Japan play into the carry trade, and how's the carry trade affect Bitcoin and gold and silver and, you know, equities, and, you know, why does this happen the way it does, or why does that happen the way I've just always had this like rabid curiosity that I can't really put down. And I think it's just a gift that I've been given and that God has blessed me with, and has made me not only follow obviously the Bitcoin rabbit hole and the macro rabbit hole, but obviously the theology and the apologetics rabbit hole and the spirituality rabbit hole, like very deeply, right? As you can tell. And it's hard to explain. I think it's like an inbuilt thing that I've received from God. You know, I remember as a kid, and even as a young man, like even in college, I'd be reading a book and I'd literally get like chills when it got to like an interesting point. You know, I'd get like energy. I'd be like tingling energy up and down my body. I'd be like, whoa, like that is so cool. Right. Or like, for example, I was in high school. So I was originally a biology student and a biology major. And in high school, at the end of high school, I got an internship at the Center for Infectious Disease Research in downtown Seattle. And this is a facility that runs on basically government grants. And it's not the CDC, but it's like kind of similar. And they were focusing on just a few major diseases, tuberculosis, malaria, and a few other, you know, small like HIV and things like that. And I got assigned to work on the tuberculosis team. And I remember going in, and again, I'm a fresh-faced biology student. I'm going into my freshman year of college, right? And we have this like 9-week internship at this institute with working with PhDs, right? Who have 10 years of experience trying to isolate certain genomic sequences within Mycobacterium tuberculosis and understanding how this bacteria works. And I remember like, this is like maybe 1 or 2 weeks in, we're doing a genetic sequencing test because we're trying to test like what genes will activate when you heat stress the bacteria, when you cold stress it, when you starve it, right? When you flood it with water, when you flood it with chemicals that are antagonistic to the tuberculosis, like what will happen? And this one gene kept popping up. And we thought, oh, okay, so it's a heat gene. Oh no, it's a cold gene because it activates. Oh no, it's a food gene. Oh wait, no, it's a general stress gene. But then when you introduce an antibiotic, which is a stressor, it's not activating. And so we're like, what is it? And he's like, well, okay, we're going to put this on the question mark list. And we go to the question mark list and it's literally a million cells long. And I asked him, I said, wait, I'm like, wait. I'm like, slow down. We just did an entire day of testing on a single gene. We don't know how it works. We don't know what it is. This genome sequence is a million long for tuberculosis. He said, no, it's 4 million base characters long. And I was like, 4 million? And he's like, yeah, it's taken us about 40 years. We've mapped less than 2%. And I was like, wait a second. I'm like, let me understand this. I'm like, each gene does something different. Each gene creates a different protein. Each protein is folded in a specific way that follows specific, you know, chemical, biochemical, and biological reactions, including complex electric engineering principles. You're telling me that this simple one-celled bacteria, which is just a nasty lung virus that people get, you know, mostly died out by now, but still exists in parts of Africa and Asia. You're telling me this thing has 4 million lines of code, and that even you, some of the smartest people in the world that have $10 million of government money to research, you don't understand it? And he's like, yeah, you know, Yeah. And I'm like, wait. Do you not see that this is intelligently designed? And he said, oh, no, I don't. It was just random. And I was like, again, full body chills. I thought, how? If you can, I'm like, I asked him, I said, okay, if you came across a computer system that was on and that had 4 million lines of code that worked perfectly, who made it? He's like, oh, yeah, well, a programmer would have made that. I mean, that's pretty big. I'm like, so this thing has 4 million lines of code that work perfectly. You only know how 2% of it works. It works in three-dimensional hyperspace, right? It has chemical reactions. It's way more complex than your computer because we know how this computer works. We built it. We don't know how a cell works. And I said, could you construct a cell from ground up? Oh, no, that technology is 100 years, 1,000 years away. So you're telling me that the simplest organism is more complex than the most complex supercomputer, and yet you're saying it's an accident. And he's like, yes. And I'm like, there we go. That's all I need to know. That is ignorance to the nth degree, right? And that's what just confirmed more of my faith and more of my curiosity. I thought, wow, I need to learn more about how the system works. And I truly don't believe, even with me being relatively smart, I don't think anyone is smart enough to figure everything out. I don't think anyone is.
Oh yeah, no chance, man. Did that taint your view of, like, so you walk me through how do you end up from a biology student studying TB to, you know, macro guy to the Peruvian bull.
So, well, I had that experience, right? Which was kind of disheartening because I was like, oh, I thought that they'd be more open to religion, but they were completely materialist.
And then you're like, better go talk to the finance bros.
No, that wasn't all of it. But I was talking to them and I realized, like, man, I can't really, like, this seems like a very tedious job. It seems very like slow, methodical, boring, and it has limited impact on your real life, right? Like if you know what 2% of Mycobacterium tuberculosis genome codes for, how is that really going to help you, like, in your day-to-day life? Not really. So I thought, I want to probably do something a little more practical than this, right? And I was introduced to finance by one of my friends who took me to, actually a friend from my church. We went and watched The Big Short together.
Nice. Dude, 10 out of 10 movie. Like
10 out of 10
probably
movie.
Probably top five. Yeah. Top five all time.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I'd already been curious about the financial crisis. And so right after that movie, I started getting obsessed with understanding how 2008 happened, why it happened. I think I read over a dozen books on 2008 alone. I read a ton of books on it and I started to dive into it, and man, it consumed my fascination, right? Because economics incorporates human psychology, mathematics, calculus, right? Physics, the actual physical limitations of how much wood there is or how much core or copper or iron ore or how much, you know, gold or silver or oil, right? It incorporates geopolitics. It incorporates, you know, class divisions, racial divisions, ethnic divisions, cultural divisions, religious divisions, right? Like everything. And so it just, my interest started exploding. And this was in September 2016 during my freshman year of college. And after about that first quarter, I was like, yep, I'm done. Like with science, I'm going to go study finance. And so I went and joined, I left the science college and I joined the business school. And the business school was great, but like I will say, like the stereotype about the finance bros is mostly true, right? They're mostly like kind of frat boy, like 100 IQ average dudes who just want to get drunk on the weekend and like play beer pong and hit on some sorority girls and then come back to like hangover and like, oh, I got to do my business math test. Oh, this is stupid. I'll do my marketing test. That's how most, or not most, but a lot of them are. But I was never like that. I was always curious and just reading.
Hmm. Do you believe in objectivity? Like, is there one kind of objectively true thing about most everything?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I've kind of been thinking about that lately. This, like, I've just started labeling myself as like a freedom maxi, a chaos maxi, and then an objective truth maxi. And just kind of believing that there is, you know, objective truth in everything we see. I think that most Bitcoiners too believe that, like, you know, objectively speaking, Bitcoin is the supreme asset on the planet. Would you, like, how do you align yourself with, I assume, like, would you align yourself with like the Bitcoin maxi kind of theology? And like, I'm not sure if theology is the right word for Bitcoin maxi, but philosophy. I'm so well read. And so how do you, find the passion then for like a gold or a silver? Like, how does a how do you go from catching the Bitcoin bug to still investigating, you know, the silver thesis and I assume owning gold, silver and stuff?
Yeah, sure. And I, you know, it's funny. You post about Bitcoin to the gold bugs, they all hate you. You post about gold and silver to the...
Stay on RT, Roberto. What are you doing?
And I will say, it's not like I have majority of my assets are in Bitcoin, right? Majority of my portfolio. I just have some exposure to gold and silver because I believe that there are still fundamental use cases for those metals. I believe that they may not be used in a monetary sense to the level that we want them to be, or that the gold bugs want them to be more precisely, but that they have real value and that they are still a good store of value across time and across space. Now, they're not as saleable as Bitcoin. They're not transactable. I don't really believe that they're money anymore. That doesn't mean that their value can't go up, especially when you're talking about a denomination like a fiat currency, which is literally, you know, infinite in its supply.
Well, yeah, but same as true of Pokemon cards or, you know, the Mona Lisa. Like I fell down the Pokemon card trail. If you go down my YouTube channel, like, you know, I did the Pokemon saga and the whole bit. Don't you see that as being short Bitcoin when you own gold?
No, I don't see that. I don't see that at all.
How do they compensate each other?
But that logic, everything you own outside of Bitcoin is short Bitcoin.
Yes. objectively speaking, that is the, yes, I would agree. How do you get around that?
I get around that because I believe that currently the majority of the wealth in the world is held by the boomer class. And the boomer class does not understand Bitcoin yet. They understand gold and silver. They understand the S&P 500. They understand 401ks and Roth IRAs. They don't get Bitcoin. And they're the ones who are making the majority of the investment decisions. And now the boomers are passing away. True. 10,000 boomers retire every day. You know, their generation is roughly 88 million people.
That's a stat. 10,000 boomers a day?
10,000 boomers retire every single day in the United States.
Dude, the pension system is cooked. That is catastrophic.
Yeah. It's really bad. It's really bad. That's why Social Security is going to be defunct, right? Bankrupt, like 5 years earlier than they thought. It's going to be, at this rate, it's going to be bankrupt by the early 2030s rather than they thought they had until like late 2030s, early 2040 for the, you know.
Is that going to be the next crisis? Like they kind of have a big print event. I think, what is it? Historically, every 12 years, the 70s, was there one between the 70s and 2001?
There was in 1992 under Bill Clinton, the Fed governor, was it Greenspan? Yeah, I think it was Greenspan, lowered rates in early to mid 1992 down to like 2 or 3%, which was very stimulative. He was trying to get out of a mild economic slump that was caused in 1991 and 92. And Clinton was, you know, or there's a George Bush, end of George Bush Sr. going into Clinton. Yeah, maybe it was George Bush Sr. George Bush Sr. was not happy about that and wanted to have a better economy. So he asked, you know, central bank lowered rate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, they did their games and they, you know, played their cards. So, I mean, you have the 70s, you have the 90s, then you have like 2000 was the big print with 9/11. You have 2008, obviously. You got 2020 with COVID. And then like, you know, probably 2030 is like about, you know, got a print. Do you think this kind of continues until like it's done, it's over, the world's, you know, fiat's no longer and we're on a Bitcoin standard and hopefully for you and your gold bugs, a gold standard or what's...
I'm not a gold bug. I'm not...
I'm kidding.
Literally like less than 10% of my portfolio is in gold and silver.
So you're 90% long Bitcoin, 10% short.
Whatever you believe.
I'm just kidding. You're just...
The reason why I own those things is because I understand that, okay, I believe, and I wrote this piece back in November. I wrote a piece called What is Value on my Substack, where I described my own personal theory of value. And my theory of value is not the subjective or objective value theories or the labor value of theory that, you know, the Marxian economists put forth. It is the utility theory of value. Things have value because they are useful to you. A sports car without gasoline on a deserted island has zero utility value, so no one will rank it as valuable. But a bunch of water on a desert island is pretty valuable. And that water, because it has utility, is valuable in almost every situation, in almost every location, at almost every time.
Yeah, it's just not scarce enough to hold value.
Yeah. But clean drinking water, it's somewhat scarce, right? Especially in the third world. And so if we use the utility theory of value, then we can kind of delineate, okay, what things like, okay, do the JPEGs and the, you know, internet NFTs of the 2021 and 2022 crypto craze, that has basically no value other than other people's perceived valuation of it.
Walk me through value of Bitcoin then. Like if we're honing to, I assume you're meaning meat space value, what's the value prop for Bitcoin?
So under this utility theory of value, there is obviously, there's still room for extra. So there's what I call intrinsic value, which is the utility value of it.
Which like for, and so sorry to cut you off again, but like, would that be for gold? Just like the fact that it conducts electricity, like you can use it in your iPhone and stuff, or
yeah.
Okay. So at the core, but, and then, so then copper is better than gold for this?
Copper, yeah. Well, gold, here's the thing is copper is good for electronics applications, obviously within sealed environments. Gold is best for complex electronics in rough environments like space or underwater because gold doesn't oxidize. Copper and silver both oxidize. And copper specifically oxidizes pretty fast. And so it loses conductivity and it loses, you know, it basically rusts away, right?
Okay. So are you copper, silver, and gold or just not?
No, silver and gold.
Silver, gold, and Bitcoin. Okay. So sorry, back to the utility theory on Bitcoin. So there's intrinsic, which is like, I can use it in my iPhone. And then what's the other one?
Extrinsic. So that's what people's subjective opinion is of it, right? And obviously,
like monkey pictures and Pokemon cards would be extrinsic.
Yeah. But the point is a single object can have both intrinsic and extrinsic value, and it can have different ratios of it, right? Like, you know, a computer could be 80% intrinsic and 20% extrinsic, right? Maybe someone really wants your, you know, your Acer computer for gaming, and because they love it and because all this gaming community loves your Acer computer, they might place a slightly higher value on your computer with a great graphics card than another random computer. Right. Or if it's, you know, has a special design or whatever. And then there's other things that are like most like art, I would argue is mostly extrinsic value. So it's like 90%, very little utility value, but it's mostly like subjective value. But that subjective value is complex because it also varies in how strong the shared illusion is. Right. So my point is for gold and silver, there's intrinsic value because there's actual like base metal use cases for it, right? They're not completely useless. Come on. Silver is used in 92% of photovoltaic cells.
Yeah, but only like 6% of silver is actually used for like this application.
For solar specifically, that's probably about right. But for general industrial use, over 65% of silver is used for that. Most, actually only 18% or so is what you'd call retail investor silver. It's mostly used as a industrial metal.
And what is it for gold? Gold is significantly less, right?
Gold is a lot less. Gold is probably 10% or 90% investment use.
How do you, like, I don't know. That seems like gymnastics to me, man. That just feels like...
No, because gold is scarce, right? Yes, it's not as scarce as Bitcoin. Okay. Even if you find another gold deposit tomorrow, it's extremely hard to mine. It's extremely hard to take out of the ground.
Sure, but the fact that it's there is what changes. Like Satoshi's coins are not just taken out of the market cap because they're hard to access, right? It's like, it's still there. And that's, I think that's kind of where Bitcoin changed the game in a lot of ways, but like the known scarcity aspect is, I think, the, you know, one of the many things that we don't talk about enough is just the fact that it's a known scarce asset, which is mind blowing.
Yeah, I agree with that. But my perception has been gold has been suppressed via the paper market manipulation from the COMEX and the LBMA for the last 30, 40 years, right? There's even letters, you know, that in the early 1970s that talk about how, you know, Kissinger and other people at the State Department were talking to high level people in Wall Street, talking about how they need to manage the price of gold. And they wanted to set up the COMEX in order to do so. So I believe that the true price of gold has been suppressed. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, like I said, the boomer generation believes in gold. The boomer generation believes in silver. They understand it. And I agree. It's not as good of an inflation hedge as Bitcoin is, but it's better than fiat. It's better than bonds. And so why not hold some exposure to it? That's the way I see it.
Yeah. I mean, fair enough. I think that sounds like short Bitcoin long gold to me, but
I understand you say that.
No, you're fine. I what I'm curious about now is you said the gold price has been suppressed since the 70s, right? 1971, WTF happened in 1971. Is this the path for Bitcoin? Bitcoin feels horribly manipulated right now. It's like, I just made this video last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago, talking about how on paper, this is just clear skies. Billionaires are here, Wall Street's here, government's here, the banks are taking it as collateral, banks are getting licenses to sell it. It's like, this is what, dude, being in this space in 2013, I've been active, like I'm debanked in Canada because of my things, because of my Bitcoin participation. And now we have the bloody government buying it. Like, it's like, this couldn't have been a greater 180. And yet, I mean, look at today, like this is going to air in a few weeks or maybe even months. Like, you know, the price today is 73K US. That's a far cry. It's almost a 50% drawdown from where it was, I think solely due to manipulation. What's going on?
I think I actually released a video about that called Something is Wrong with Bitcoin. I think that the fundamental market structure has changed, right? There's a lot more institutions that are playing in the Bitcoin space now than there were 4 or 5 years ago. We have 11 ETFs, right? Launched by several large asset managers, BlackRock, State Street, right? Fidelity has now become an approved custodian for Bitcoin. You have Michael Saylor and his army of, you know, hornets, whatever he calls them, you know, cyber hornets going crazy, buying Bitcoin, buying the stock, issuing convertible bonds, issuing premium preferred shares, issuing common shares to buy more Bitcoin. The institutions have arrived, right? And paper Bitcoin futures, obviously, and options and forwards and all these complex contracts have all developed, and hedge funds are now trading it, right? And whenever you do that, whenever you create those, you know, you could call them tangential derivative markets, you redirect demand away from the fundamental core commodity and you put it into these speculative assets, right? Because all this money that would have just bought the Bitcoin is now like, oh, why don't we just buy the options on it and get some convexity? And why don't we hedge that option with a future? And then why don't we hedge the future with a swap? And we can just, you know, keep doing this forever and never actually hold the actual Bitcoin, but we'll have synthetic exposure to it with leverage. That's the game that's been played, right? And so I think obviously they can do that for a while, but I think ultimately the difference with Bitcoin and with gold is that their leash on Bitcoin is so much shorter. Because with gold, you actually have to find the actual gold. You have to call it in for delivery. You have to ship it somewhere, right? That's what China's been doing. The Chinese Shanghai exchange only deals in physical metal. And their exchange has been basically withdrawing massive amounts of bullion from the West, right? They've been, COMEX has drawn down like 40% in the month of January alone for the registered silver inventory. The Shanghai premium is now for silver is in excess of $10 an ounce, which is like almost 10% of the price. So basically you can make free money if you're a trader by buying gold silver contracts in New York at $90 an ounce. And actually right now, well, it's $10 or so average for the month of January. But right now, as we're speaking in early February, the premium is something like $40 an ounce because it's selling for 130 an ounce in China and it's selling for 90 in the US. So traders can buy in the US, ship it directly to Shanghai and sell it for 130 an ounce and profit $40 an ounce minus the shipping and, you know, security costs. Because right now there's a rush for China. The Chinese citizens don't really have access to crypto and they're going through an economic and financial crisis. That's not on Western TV because not much news is allowed to escape. But because of that, the Chinese citizens are rushing into gold and silver as a safety hedge. And that's like their only, you know, route. Bitcoin mining has been banned in China. Buying Bitcoin is heavily restricted. Moving capital out is heavily restricted, right? One of the only ways you can move capital out is actually by investing in real estate, which is why Canada has seen the real estate prices explode because all these Chinese wealthy people were like, hey, we want to get our money out of this economy that's a house of cards. We'll all buy Canadian real estate and that drives up Canadian prices. But yeah, this dynamic has been playing out between China and the US.
Crazy, man. So then where does it go? Like what, you know, Bitcoin is broken. Something is fundamentally wrong with Bitcoin. Yeah, you know, I agree. We're in one of the most uncertain economic times in history and retail feels like they're asleep. What fixes it?
What fixes it is the next Fed easing cycle. So once the Fed starts to cut rates in earnest, right, and really become dovish and the QE starts either via stealth mechanisms or via overt, I think the money flowing into the financial system will bid up basically every single risk asset, including Bitcoin. And I have a piece of my Substack that track a gold run and a Bitcoin run, and it found that gold front ran Bitcoin by an average of 18 months in the last three cycles, right? So if that's the case, and this gold bull run started, you know, 2024, 2025, right? We should be seeing...
bull season, baby.
Yeah, we should be seeing a bullish run, you know, second half of this year, roughly. But again, who knows? Like, they can manipulate it lower. They can do whatever shenanigans they want with the price. What I tell people is the paper price on the screen, the ticker price, doesn't really matter because the fundamental intrinsic value is so much higher than that, which is why you're buying it, right? Because you believe that the value of it is higher than the price that you're paying for it, or else you would have no logical reason to buy it. So keep stacking, keep buying, keep hodling, right? When we re-engineer this financial system and take away power from this global cabal, right? These central bankers, we'll be using Bitcoin for transactions. And then you divide, like Knut Svenholm, or I don't know how to pronounce the last name, like he says, divide everything in the world by 21 million. What's the price of Bitcoin? It's a lot higher than $73,000.
Yeah, man. I think, what is it? $900 trillion in global GDP.
And financial assets, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, two of it, or 1.5 of it now is Bitcoin. Like, we got a ways to climb. Dude, this is probably a good spot to wrap it. If you have anything, we talked about your lunch, carnivore, demons, gold. We realized that you're a gold maxi and you're giving in your Bitcoin maxi card. We talked about your dad as a cloud wizard. Like, we've covered all the topics. Is there anything else that you figure we should brush on before we let you fly?
No, there's not anything I want to touch on now. Thanks for having me on, Adam. This was a blast. We definitely need to do this again. Yeah, if you guys are interested I will tweet about religious stuff occasionally and about spirituality and Christianity. I had a tweet actually go viral just a few days ago about the spiritual war between good and evil and how Christ wins. I got like 150,000 views and like 10,000 likes. That's a lot of engagement. So I got really good positive feedback from that. So I do tweet about that occasionally, but I mostly focus on macro. You can follow me at Peruvian_bull on Twitter. I also have a YouTube channel called Peruvian Bull, which we just started a couple months ago, and we're launching, you know, new financial and macroeconomic topics on. So you can check that out. And I also have a Substack called Dollar Endgame, which is again just like a macro and finance Substack. And I talk about Bitcoin and gold and silver and everything on there.
And that's the name of your book too, right? Dollar Endgame?
Dollar Endgame, yes. That's also the name of my book.
Okay. Buy the book. Sick, man. Well, Roberto, listen, we didn't even get into the big identity reveal, but maybe on the next one, we'll get into the identity reveal of the Peruvian bull. But thank you so much for coming on, man. It's a blast. And yeah, I'll catch you later.
Sweet. Sounds good. Thanks for having me. Bye.
Whew, that one was another good episode. Really love how Roberto has the ability to just be open and talk about these things as fact. I love his confidence. I love his ability to both be confident and humble in his responses. And I just have so much respect for his journey and the conversation that we just had. Once again, week over week, I'm finding myself having these incredible conversations with Bitcoiners and just feel so blessed that you are watching them and that this show gets to help me explore all these topics that I probably wouldn't otherwise have the ability or opportunity to do. So for those of you that don't know me, my name is Adam O'Brien. Thank you so much for sticking it out this far in the episode. I'm the founder and CEO of a Bitcoin company called Bitcoin Well. We're publicly traded. I took that public at the age of 29. I'm also co-founder and CEO at a media company called GetBase, where we are on a mission to awaken the sovereign individual. Above all, I'm a follower of Jesus. I'm a husband to my beautiful wife, Christina, and I'm a father to our 4 and soon to be 5 kids. I'm here to relentlessly pursue objective truth. And I wanna find ways to lead a more biblical life and ultimately point my family towards generational faith and prosperity. If any of that interests you, please subscribe. We have these conversations every single week, and I would love to hear from you in the comments down below. So thanks so much for watching, and I'll see you next week.